Granddaddy of Horror, bringing you audiobook versions of classic horror fiction, with a new episode every week. Tonight, on Granddaddy of Horror, Chapters 11 and 12 of Carmilla, by J. Sheridan Le Fanu. Last week's episode ended in a cliffhanger. Laura's father has asked that she and Madame Perrodin join him on a day trip to the ruins of Karnstein. On the way, they meet General Spielsdorf, who is invited to jump in the carriage and join the expedition. The original plan was to meet a priest and have a picnic lunch at the local ruins. The general has added monster hunting to the agenda, but hasn't been terribly clear about what monsters he's after or why. At the end of chapter 10, Laura's father said,
"Pray let us hear the story you were so good as to promise."
We resume with the general's response.
Chapter 11. The Story.
"With all my heart,"
said the general, with an effort, and after a short pause in which to arrange his subject, he commenced one of the strangest narratives I ever heard.
"My dear child was looking forward, with great pleasure, to the visit you had been so good as to arrange for her, to your charming daughter."
Here, he made me a gallant, but melancholy bow.
"In the meantime, we had an invitation to my old friend, the Count Karlsfeld, whose schloss is about 6 leagues to the other side of Karnstein. It was to attend the series of fêtes which, you remember, were given by him in honour of his illustrious visitor, the Grand Duke Charles."
"Yes, and very splendid, I believe they were,"
said my father.
"Princely. But then his hospitalities are quite regal. He has Aladdin's lamp. The night from which my sorrow dates was devoted to a magnificent masquerade. The grounds were thrown open, the trees hung with coloured lamps. There was such a display of fireworks as Paris itself had never witnessed, and such music. Music, you know, is my weakness. Such ravishing music, the finest instrumental band, perhaps, in the world, and the finest singers who could be collected from all the great operas in Europe. As you wandered through these fantastically illuminated grounds, the moonlighted chateau throwing a rosy light from its long rows of windows, you would suddenly hear these ravishing voices stealing from the silence of some grove, or rising from boats upon the lake. I felt myself, as I looked and listened, carried back into the romance and poetry of my early youth. When the fireworks were ended, and the ball beginning, we returned to the noble suite of rooms that were thrown open to the dancers. A masked ball, you know, is a beautiful sight, but so brilliant a spectacle of the kind I never saw before. It was a very aristocratic assembly. I was myself almost the only nobody present. My dear child was looking quite beautiful. She wore no mask. Her excitement and delight added an unspeakable charm to her features, always lovely. I remarked a young lady, dressed magnificently, but wearing a mask, who appeared to me to be observing my ward with extraordinary interest. I had seen her, earlier in the evening, in the great hall, and again, for a few minutes, walking near us, on the terrace under the castle windows, similarly employed. A lady, also masked, richly and gravely dressed, and with a stately air, like a person of rank, accompanied her as a chaperone. Had the young lady not worn a mask, I could, of course, have been much more certain upon the question whether she was really watching my poor darling. I am now well assured that she was. We were now in one of the salons. My poor dear child had been dancing and was resting a little in one of the chairs near the door. I was standing near. The two ladies I have mentioned had approached, and the younger took the chair next my ward, while her companion stood beside me, and for a little time addressed herself, in a low tone, to her charge. Availing herself of the privilege of her mask, she turned to me, and in the tone of an old friend, and calling me by my name, opened a conversation with me, which piqued my curiosity a good deal. She referred to many scenes where she had met me at court, and at distinguished houses. She alluded to little incidents, which I had long ceased to think of, but which, I found, had only lain in abeyance in my memory, for they instantly started into life at her touch. I became more and more curious to ascertain who she was, every moment. She parried my attempts to discover, very adroitly and pleasantly. The knowledge she showed of many passages in my life seemed to me all but unaccountable, and she appeared to take a not unnatural pleasure in foiling my curiosity, and in seeing me flounder, in my eager perplexity, from one conjecture to another. In the meantime, the young lady, whom her mother called by the odd name of Milarca, when she once or twice addressed her, had, with the same ease and grace, got into conversation with my ward. She introduced herself by saying that her mother was a very old acquaintance of mine. She spoke of the agreeable audacity which a mask rendered practicable. She talked like a friend. She admired her dress, and insinuated very prettily her admiration of her beauty. She amused her with laughing criticisms upon the people who crowded the ballroom, and laughed at my poor child's fun. She was very witty and lively when she pleased, and after a time they had grown very good friends, and the young stranger lowered her mask, displaying a remarkably beautiful face. I had never seen it before, neither had my dear child. But, though it was new to us, the features were so engaging, as well as lovely, that it was impossible not to feel the attraction powerfully. My poor girl did so. I never saw anyone more taken with another at first sight, unless, indeed, it was the stranger herself, who seemed quite to have lost her heart to her. In the meantime, availing myself of the license of a masquerade, I put not a few questions to the elder lady. "You have puzzled me utterly," I said, laughing. "Is that not enough? Won't you now consent to stand on equal terms and do me the kindness to remove your mask?"
"Can any request be more unreasonable?"
she replied.
"Ask a lady to yield an advantage. Beside, how do you know you should recognize me? Years make changes."
"As you see," I said with a bow, and, I suppose, a rather melancholy little laugh.
"As philosophers tell us,"
she said.
"And how do you know that a sight of my face would help you?"
"I should take chance for that," I answered. "It is vain trying to make yourself out an old woman. Your figure betrays you."
"Years, nevertheless, have passed since I saw you. Rather, since you saw me, for that is what I am considering. Milarca there is my daughter. I cannot then be young, even in the opinion of people whom time has taught to be indulgent. And I may not like to be compared with what you remember me. You have no mask to remove. You can offer me nothing in exchange."
"My petition is to your pity, to remove it."
"And mine to yours, to let it stay where it is,"
she replied. "Well then, at least you will tell me whether you are French or German. You speak both languages so perfectly."
"I don't think I shall tell you that, General. You intend a surprise, and are meditating the particular point of attack."
"At all events, you won't deny this," I said. "That, being honoured by your permission to converse, I ought to know how to address you. Shall I say Madame la Comtesse?" She laughed, and she would, no doubt, have met me with another evasion. If, indeed, I can treat any occurrence in an interview every circumstance of which was prearranged, as I now believe, with the profoundest cunning, as liable to be modified by accident.
"As to that,"
she began, but she was interrupted, almost as she opened her lips, by a gentleman dressed in black, who looked particularly elegant and distinguished, with this drawback, that his face was the most deadly pale I ever saw, except in death. He was in no masquerade, in the plain evening dress of a gentleman, and he said, without a smile, but with a courtly and unusually low bow,
Will Madame la Comtesse permit me to say a very few words, which may interest her?
The lady turned quickly to him, and touched her lip in token of silence. She then said to me,
"Keep my place for me, General. I shall return when I have said a few words."
And with this injunction, playfully given, she walked a little aside with the gentleman in black, and talked for some minutes, apparently very earnestly. They then walked away slowly together in the crowd, and I lost them for some minutes. I spent the interval in cudgelling my brains for a conjecture as to the identity of the lady, who seemed to remember me so kindly, and I was thinking of turning about and joining in the conversation between my pretty ward and the Countess's daughter, and trying whether, by the time she returned, I might not have a surprise in store for her, by having her name, title, chateau, and estates at my fingers' ends. But, at this moment, she returned, accompanied by the pale man in black, who said,
"I shall return, and inform Madame la Comtesse when her carriage is at the door."
He withdrew, with a bow.
Chapter 12. A Petition.
"Then we are to lose Madame la Comtesse, but I hope only for a few hours," I said, with a low bow.
"It may be that only. Or it may be a few weeks. It was very unlucky, his speaking to me just now, as he did. Do you now know me?"
I assured her I did not.
"You shall know me,"
she said,
"but not at present. We are older and better friends than, perhaps, you suspect. I cannot yet declare myself. I shall, in 3 weeks, pass your beautiful Schloss, about which I have been making inquiries. I shall then look in upon you for an hour or two, and renew a friendship which I never think of without a thousand pleasant recollections. This moment, a piece of news has reached me like a thunderbolt. I must set out now, and travel by a devious route, nearly 100 miles, with all the dispatch I can possibly make. My perplexities multiply. I am only deterred by the compulsory reserve I practice, as to my name, from making a very singular request of you. My poor child has not quite recovered her strength. Her horse fell with her, at a hunt which she had ridden out to witness. Her nerves have not yet recovered the shock, and our physician says that she must, on no account, exert herself for some time to come. We came here, in consequence, by very easy stages, hardly 6 leagues a day. I must now travel day and night, on a mission of life and death, a mission, the critical and momentous nature of which I shall be able to explain to you when we meet, as I hope we shall, in a few weeks, without the necessity of any concealment."
She went on to make her petition, and it was in the tone of a person from whom such a request amounted to conferring, rather than seeking a favour. This was only in manner, and, as it seemed, quite unconsciously. Than the terms in which it was expressed, nothing could be more deprecatory. It was simply that I would consent to take charge of her daughter during her absence. This was, all things considered, a strange, not to say, an audacious request. She, in some sort, disarmed me, by stating and admitting everything that could be urged against it, and throwing herself entirely upon my chivalry. At the same moment, by a fatality that seems to have predetermined all that happened, my poor child came to my side, and, in an undertone, besought me to invite her new friend, Milarca, to pay us a visit. She had just been sounding her, and thought, if her mamma would allow her, she would like it extremely. At another time I should have told her to wait a little, until, at least, we knew who they were. But I had not a moment to think in. The two ladies assailed me together, and, I must confess, the refined and beautiful face of the young lady, about which there was something extremely engaging, as well as the elegance and fire of high birth, determined me, and, quite overpowered, I submitted, and undertook, too easily, the care of the young lady, whom her mother called Milarca. The Countess beckoned to her daughter, who listened with grave attention while she told her, in general terms, how suddenly and peremptorily she had been summoned, and also of the arrangement she had made for her under my care, adding that I was one of her earliest and most valued friends. I made, of course, such speeches as the case seemed to call for, and found myself, on reflection, in a position which I did not half like. The gentleman in black returned, and very ceremoniously conducted the lady from the room. The demeanour of this gentleman was such as to impress me with the conviction that the Countess was a lady of very much more importance than her modest title alone might have led me to assume. Her last charge to me was that no attempt was to be made to learn more about her than I might have already guessed, until her return. Our distinguished host, whose guest she was, knew her reasons.
"But here,"
she said,
"neither I nor my daughter could safely remain for more than a day. I removed my mask, imprudently, for a moment, about an hour ago. And, too late, I fancied you saw me. So, I resolved to seek an opportunity of talking a little to you. Had I found that you had seen me, I should have thrown myself on your high sense of honor, to keep my secret for some weeks. As it is, I am satisfied that you did not see me. But, if you now suspect, or, on reflection, should suspect who I am, I commit myself, in like manner, entirely to your honor. My daughter will observe the same secrecy, and, I well know that you will, from time to time, remind her, lest she should thoughtlessly disclose it."
She whispered a few words to her daughter, kissed her hurriedly twice, and went away, accompanied by the pale gentleman in black, and disappeared in the crowd.
"In the next room,"
said Milarka,
"there is a window that looks upon the hall door. I should like to see the last of Mama, and to kiss my hand to her."
We assented, of course, and accompanied her to the window. We looked out, and saw a handsome old-fashioned carriage with a troop of couriers and footmen. We saw the slim figure of the pale gentleman in black as he held a thick velvet cloak, and placed it about her shoulders, and threw the hood over her head. She nodded to him, and just touched his hand with hers. He bowed low repeatedly, as the door closed, and the carriage began to move.
"She is gone,"
said Milarka, with a sigh. "She's gone," I repeated to myself. For the first time, in the hurried moments that had elapsed since my consent, reflecting upon the folly of my act.
"She did not look up,"
said the young lady, plaintively. "The Countess had taken off her mask perhaps, and did not care to show her face," I said, "and she could not know that you were in the window." She sighed, and looked in my face. She was so beautiful that I relented. I was sorry I had, for a moment, repented of my hospitality, and I determined to make her amends for the unavowed churlishness of my reception. The young lady, replacing her mask, joined my ward in persuading me to return to the grounds, where the concert was soon to be renewed. We did so, and walked up and down the terrace that lies under the castle windows. Milarka became very intimate with us, and amused us with lively descriptions and stories of most of the great people whom we saw upon the terrace. I liked her more and more every minute. Her gossip, without being ill-natured, was extremely diverting to me, who had been so long out of the great world. I thought what life she would give to our sometimes lonely evenings at home. This ball was not over until the morning sun had almost reached the horizon. It pleased the Grand Duke to dance till then, so loyal people could not go away or think of bed. We had just got through a crowded saloon when my ward asked me what had become of Milarka. I thought she had been by her side, and she fancied she was by mine. The fact was, we had lost her. All my efforts to find her were vain. I feared that she had mistaken, in the confusion of a momentary separation from us, other people for her new friends, and had, possibly, pursued and lost them, in the extensive grounds which were thrown open to us. Now, in its full force, I recognized a new folly in my having undertaken the charge of a young lady without so much as knowing her name, and, fettered as I was by promises, of the reasons for imposing which I knew nothing, I could not even point my inquiries by saying that the missing young lady was the daughter of the Countess, who had taken her departure a few hours before morning broke. It was clear daylight before I gave up my search. It was not till near 2 o'clock next day that we heard anything of my missing charge. At about that time, a servant knocked at my niece's door to say that he had been earnestly requested by a young lady, who appeared to be in great distress, to make out where she could find the General Baron Spielsdorf and the young lady his daughter, in whose charge she had been left by her mother. There could be no doubt, notwithstanding the slight inaccuracy, that our young friend had turned up, and so she had. Would to heaven we had lost her. She told my poor child a story to account for her having failed to recover us for so long. Very late, she said, she had got to the housekeeper's bedroom in despair of finding us, and had then fallen into a deep sleep, which, long as it was, had hardly sufficed to recruit her strength after the fatigues of the ball. That day, Milarka came home with us. I was only too happy, after all, to have secured so charming a companion for my dear girl.
You've been listening to Granddaddy of Horror, a podcast created by C. Levi Farrell. All rights reserved. Join us next week for chapters 13 and 14 of Carmilla.